This is Maurice Sumner, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 30th of January 2013. Maurice Sumner, Part 1.
My name is Maurice Reginald Sumner. Place of birth is Brighton, Sussex. My age is 77 now. The precise birthday is 25th of the 3rd, 1935.
Right. Would you say your father was an educated man?
No, he was a very humble man. He was a shopkeeper in Brighton, and he never asserted anything. He was just an ordinary primary school boy of a large sort of Edwardian family. And then he went off to the war for 5 years to India, which on reflection turned out to be his great adventure. You know, he didn't like the idea and never volunteered, but he had a whale of a time. Difficult getting back into Civvy Street when he came back. You know, that was an adventure and a half. He didn't see frontline action. He just saw India in its probably in its best way in many respects. But I had a lot of time for him.
Were you born over the shop then?
No, I was born nearby, but it was in the same locale. The background to the family is my mother and her five sisters were Irish immigrants. They'd run out of potatoes and they needed to do something. And I mean, when you think of it now, they just up sticks with Grandad and came to Britain. Many, many Irish families did. They went into service in the hotels. Grandad went into the front room, and they lived through the war like that. I just took it as normal. You know, you don't think much about those things as a child. But it must have been a tremendous heave for the family. And we saw the war out together, sitting huddled in a Anderson shelter.
You're talking about the Second War now, of course.
Yes, yes. I'm only 77.
What about your own education, Maurice? What was that like?
My education was fairly poor. It was the normal rudimentary first school, which was down the end of the road, which I reflect on it now wasn't really that great. I managed to fail the 11 plus. I now think, with just a bit of extra care, I could have flown through that, but I didn't. And therefore, I missed out on grammar schools and just ploughed on with the normal primary schools. Then some politician had a brainwave that make other schools into building schools, where they taught you the labours of the building trade. And I thought, well, this is better than what I've got. My parents thought it was too, and I went there. In fact, it was a bit of a disappointment because that particular recipe, the teacher who was the head teacher was really a frustrated public school boy who wanted to make this into a grammar school. Well, he missed out a stage and it didn't work. And that school didn't go far. But anyway, it may still be there, I don't know. But I went to a couple of, one in particular, Roman Catholic schools. They were all Roman Catholics from Southern Ireland. We went to Mass on Sunday, confession every month. And we took it very seriously. And this little school in Elm Grove in Brighton, called St. Joseph's, was I met the headmistress, who was an iron lady, just a few years ago. I hadn't seen her for years, and I was able to say to her, I went to about five schools and yours was the best ever. And she glowed. She really did. And I think it was. It had a discipline and a way of teaching which appealed to me.
Do you feel that stood you in good stead for later then?
Yes. Yes, I do. Because I didn't have a key education. I often wish I had, you know, a school with a proud sort of pathway. And when people ask you, where did you go to school? You know, it's naff, isn't it?
If you can't say Eton, you might as well keep your mouth shut.
Yeah, quite. That's right. Anyhow, that was the school days, and I left.
How old?
15. And I then started the interminable evening classes, just trying to catch up. And that seemed to go on for years in various further education colleges in Brighton. And eventually I finished up with an education, engineering national certificate.
Why do you lean towards engineering, do you think?
Well, left school, my first job was at a factory quite close to where my father's shop was. He was, I think I told you, a retailer in men's clothes, an outfitter. And behind him was Alan West, which was a big employer in Brighton. You know, they made switchgear and electrical equipment. And I went into that as a callow youth out of school and started to learn how to hit a hammer. But it was a reasonable, you know, you didn't have to hunt for a job. You could just walk into those. It's a bit different now.
What would have been your first awareness that there was a place on this planet called the Antarctic?
Well, I can't remember the first, but I can remember the day I spotted an advert in the I think it was a Mail, which said 2 years in the Antarctic. And they invited people to go for 2 years, that was then, as a meteorological observer. And I was restless then. I was looking for some way of seeing across the western approaches. You know. Mm. And then I maybe a little bit before that, I'd been called up for national service. And I leapt at it. I could have been deferred, but I leapt at it. I thought, at last I can go to Malaya and these places like that. And in fact, I enjoyed my national service, 2 years in the RAF. I finished up on boats. The, what's it called? The air sea rescue. And I enjoyed that. I was trained quite close to here. But I was 18 months there and learning to be a wireless mechanic. And then when I passed out from that, we were distributed and I hoped I would go abroad. And I went to New Haven, which was a 1 and 9 penny bus ride from my family. And they used to come down in the evening to make sure I was all right. So I hadn't seen anything of the Antarctic then until I spotted that advert and I applied for it.
Had you read though about Scott
yes,
and Shackleton?
Yes, but vaguely, not an in-depth thing. But when I started to look at it, I then gathered all the literature I could get so that I could at least be interviewed on the subject.
What was it that made you go for it, do you think?
Well, it was adventure. You know, I could have stayed in the Air Force for another few years, but I couldn't see I could get into air crew. I wanted something with a purpose, and it was just another job. But I hadn't seen much on television then. This was in early 60s or late 50s, wasn't it? And just a lollipop that I fancied. And
what was your parents' reaction, Maurice?
They didn't mind at all. They followed it with interest. And they never actually expressed it, but they didn't stand in my way. You know, that's what I wanted to do. That's what I did. And I signed on for that. Well, I had an interview.
Do you remember the interview?
Just with Johnny Green.
And somebody else, a female personal
officer?
Yes,
there was a female, wasn't there? What was her name?
Anne Todd?
Yeah, she's still there, isn't she?
Still alive, yes.
Yeah, well, she still goes to the office every Sunday. I don't think she knows about retirement, Anne Todd. Yeah, I don't think I was interviewed by her. She didn't do much interviewing. There were one or two. There was a bevy of women. I eventually married one. And they were very loyal people. And the interview went well. You have to be careful. You know, there are apocryphal questions that bring out silly answers, like what was the one about... Have you read anything of... Scott. Yes, I've read all his novels. That sort of thing. So you've got to be careful what you say.
What happened next then?
Well, then I was told on the phone, I can remember the day, you're accepted for training. And we then were shipped out to the Met Office in Essex to be trained. And the training was excellent.
How much did you know about meteorology prior to that?
None.
Nothing at all?
No, they were
that
just...
didn't matter?
No, it didn't. We weren't forecasters. We were just data collectors. They didn't dress it up and say you were a scientist or anything like that. You just had statistical forms to fill in a precise way for every god waking hour of the day through the 2 years. And that stood us in good stead, because that's long-term monitoring at its best. It's not sexy, it's boring to anybody who's looking for something with a headline. But because we had such precise data, we discovered the ozone hole. Mm. And one leads to the other. You know, you've got the good data and you can see an aberration there, and that's what Joe Farman... Have you met Joe yet?
Not Joe. I've met Brian. Mm. Brian Gardner.
Ah, yes.
Interviewed Brian.
Yes.
I'll tell you a story about him later on, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
When you say we discover the ozone layer, you mean the Antarctic,
yes,
British Antarctic Survey.
I remember.
But you were recording weather patterns 25 years ahead of that paper being published.
Yes, that's right. But that's what you need. You need it over decades. And they got the model of data collection really very well, because we put a balloon up every day of the year. We could. If it was blowing a hooli, you couldn't get one up. And filled in the stats straight away, and then it was signalled straight to the collection centre via Port Stanley. So the whole of that section of the globe was really covered beautifully for the whole of the southern hemisphere.
But you weren't actually taking ozone readings?
Well, I did a bit of that. There was an ozone spectrophotometer on the first base and the second one. And it was really Heath Robinson. In order to get the curve that you were trying to measure, I can't remember the details, we had to soot up a brass plate and then run a line based on the readings we were looking at. So that was being done for decades beforehand. And then when Joe suddenly found something odd, only he could do that. He was an exceptional man. He smoked like a chimney, and he could look at a bunch of printout that thick, whereas most of us would glass over. You know, it's just figures on figures on figures. And he spotted an aberration. Now, this stuff was all in the public domain. It went out to the states and all the contributing countries. Nobody had spotted this aberration. So he just lit his pipe yet again and ran it again, thinking it might be a computer glitch. And it wasn't. And then he had that moment in time, which scientists dream about, that they found something and they can do a short paragraph for Nature. And then suddenly the world heard about it. And then a week later they were sitting in Downing Street with the Iron Lady. She was looking at it, wondering what it was all about. And the rest is history now.
When you heard the news in 1985, what were your feelings? Were you surprised? Were you pleased to be part of it all?
Yes, I was. I mean, that's what we were down there for, you know, to get a first like that. And it took a long time for the implications to be digested. Mm. And a lot of people said, no, it's nothing, you know, it'll close up tomorrow. It didn't, but I know there was a lot of traffic about what was the cause. Forgotten PCBs, HCBs, something like that, which was the reason for the hole.
CFCs?
CFCs, I think.
One thing that worried them as they prepared to publish, this is, I remember this in my interview with Brian Gardner, who was one of Joe's three colleagues, was whilst everything they had in front of them added up, they couldn't be sure of the veracity of the recordings and the readings made by FIDS in the field 25 years ago. Now, can you put your hand on your heart and say that the ozone readings you were making were faithfully and carefully and scientifically recorded?
Well, we did what we were told to do, and it wasn't difficult. We were inside the hut looking through a hole in the roof, and I can remember there was a wheel we had to turn and keep a needle going. I can't remember the details of it. But we had no reason to think that we weren't measuring ozone and that it had suddenly found itself wanting. I mean, there aren't many examples like that. You know, it's a.
So your view is that you were diligent in the work you did at that time?
Well, it wasn't difficult. You know, compared to the ordinary meteorology, which is just measure of temperature, pressure, humidity, that was so routine. You could hardly mess it up. You could miss an ob, but we didn't miss many. They were quite diligent about it, and you had to get the line right in the stats, and they were quite good. Yeah.
Did you know at that time why you were recording the ozone levels?
No.
It was just a reading.
It was a reading. I said, well, you know, I said ozone, I thought that came from Brighton. the breeze.
The ozone's far better in Rottingdean, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
We've leaped about a bit, but it's not a problem. But technically, you're still on the northern side of the equator. We haven't got you on the ship yet.
Yes. That was first year on the base.
So you went to Stanmore and did your training. Well, yeah. You said it was very good. Why do you think it was good?
Well, it was particularly detailed. You know, at the end of the session, you knew what you were supposed to be doing. You know, it wasn't airy-fairy. There was lots of courses I've been on which have been at the end of it you say, well, what did I learn, you know, and you still don't know. So it was a good, well constructed course. And then we went up to Hemsby and I met a girl there, but I won't go into that. And I got very good at darts there.
Well, I'm told you were exceptionally good at darts. In the Bell.
Yeah, the Bell at Hemsby.
Yeah
Yeah, we transformed that little village.
Tell me how you did that.
Well, we were down there every night and we played a game of darts, and then whoever won took on the next, and you bought each other half a beer, and by the end of the evening we was pissed. And that was a nice way of doing it. So then we threw a party for all the local workers who came into the bar, and they took us into their hearts. You know, we were some almost like Martians, I think. Where are you going?
Well, they must have been used to in the Bell to the trainees from.
Well, I don't know.
The Met trainees.
Yeah, not necessarily going to the Antarctic. They were just for the Met office. They would be bound for stations in UK.
Dudley Jehan, who's a long-term friend of yours, said that the result was that Morris won so many points, not only for himself, but also for me and for everybody else in the pub. And we'd wend our way back to our digs the worse for wear.
Yes.
Do you deny that?
No. That was the object of the exercise.
You were learning Radio Sonde in Norfolk.
Yes.
And how did that...
That was another very good, precise course. You know, it was a bitty thing. This little gadget, I don't know if you've seen them, they've got a little windmill on them. They've got the temperature, pressure and humidity, which had to be calibrated in a separate container inside the hut. And you started off with the calibration. So you had an hour's work. And you had blown up the balloon the night before. And then you transferred this thing underneath the balloon. The trouble was getting the balloon high enough, because you had a trail of twine from the neck of the balloon to the sonde, and if you couldn't get it high enough, it would just smash on the floor. You know, if the wind was that strong, it would be too horizontal. And so we would try twice and then say, well, we can't get it up over 30 knots, we can't just get the damn thing up. And nobody complained about that. You know,
what were you filling it with?
Hydrogen.
And how are you creating that?
We had a hydrogen mill. Scary thing. It was a lump of metal with crystals of caustic crystals and then lead pellets, I think it was. And you had to shovel it in, and then it started to brew. And I often thought then, you know, it must have been terrible hazard. It was away from the station itself, in a balloon shed of its own, so nothing ever happened. We never had a problem with the generation of hydrogen, but it took about an hour and a half to get the balloon filled so that it was on the surface. Then it went up to about 30,000 feet, burst and disappeared.
What was the diameter of the balloon? It was about
6 foot when it was launched, but by the time it had got to the top, it was about 35 feet. But we followed it with a radar. We had a radar on the base. We could follow it and plot its position every few minutes and get the upper atmosphere winds.
And what was hanging from it?
A transmitter, a radio transmitter with a battery. And that was cycling these three
readings
of temperature, pressure and humidity. Humidity is always a difficult thing when the temperature gets low. You know, it's sort of a vertical line. You can't really measure it.
Would this have been a kamikaze transmitter? You never saw it again?
No, never saw it again. Mm. It was accepted that they probably dropped on a few people's heads, but I never heard of an occasion when it did.
And the information you got from you received from the radio sonde, that just was logged in the usual way and sent to Stanley?
Yeah. We had a beat instrument where you had to get a null point and then plot it. It was quite a difficult thing to do. You were listening to the signal as it circulated 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. You had to get the beat, measure the cycles of that beat, then find it on the graph, and you'd finish up with three separate graphs. And at first it was chaos, you know, but we got quite good at it. In fact, the people in the Hemsby school reckoned that our performance on the radio sonde was better than the Met Office's, but they were just buttering us up, I think.
So that particular part of Norfolk must have been showered with radio sonde transmitters then?
No, they would maybe travel 30 or 40 miles before they came down. You know, the flight would take maybe 2.5 hours. Mm. And then it would probably drop into the sea, the North Sea. So I never heard of anybody getting hit. And they're still doing it every day of the week.
Well, they are, yeah. Was there any other kind of training before you departed? Were you given health and safety, a crevasse rescue training, skiing lessons?
No. We talked about it and sidled up to it, but somehow it's, I don't remember specific courses. Certainly we weren't taught to ski. We all skied with our feet out here, you know, a wide base. But it was difficult skiing in the Antarctic because the snow was brittle and wind cut, so it's full of ruts and holes. And you always had to climb the hill you just slid down, and soon wore off.
So the next step really was to catch a boat, I presume.
Yep. Let me think. We were all summer at Stanmore and at Hemsby, and we felt that we really knew our stuff by the time we'd finished, but we knew little or nothing about the Antarctic. And then we went down to Southampton to the where the Cunards came. You know, it was the Premier Key, berth 37. And there was this squatty little red ship, the Kistadan. It was known as the effing hell ship. It had a round bottom. I expect the others have told you this. It's a round bottom, and it rocked on damp grass. It was that shape so that it could squeeze up when pressured by the ice. And in fact, that's what happened when we got down there. We were pressured, and it tilts, and then nothing stays on the tables. But we had, before that, when we got there, we were allocated the forecastle bunk right on the sharp end. And we thought it was quite nice, you know, it had all the facilities, didn't have a shower, had a loo of its own. But we had to, you had to go across the open decks. When we got on it, they were open, but by the time the ship sailed, it had about 1,000 drums of fuel in the well deck, and you had to get across that to get to your cabin.
Clambering over the fuel.
Yeah. And invariably, we went into a typical Biscay storm. Did Dudley tell you about that?
Yeah,
well, I've done a lot of sailing since then. I don't know if you mentioned it, but I've spent a lot of time on small boat sailing.
New Zealand and back.
That's right.
Yeah.
I've nothing compared to that journey. We stood on our heads and rolled more than I've ever rolled before. And every time we wanted to get up to the back end to eat, we got drenched. You know, green seas came over. It was quite dramatic. I mean, it went on right to past Madeira. And then the climate gradually improved.
Did you fear for your life?
No. We didn't have any fear for that. We were just bloody uncomfortable. And the ship was just a little cargo ship. It didn't have any drying facilities. If you put your wet clothes on the railings by the engine room, they dried all right. They dried like a stiff board with loads of grease marks on them, you know, and you chuck those out. No, it was not very good. And the other thing about it was a Danish ship, Lauritsen Line, and they felt that the right food for us was dainty little,
smorgasbord?
Yeah, a variety of little biscuits with things like caviar and bits of egg. They tasted nice, but they didn't fill you. But that was what they thought was good cuisine. What we wanted was bread and dripping, I think. And we were on that boat a long time. A couple of months, really. Mm. And I'll come back to that in a minute.
Was the word you were looking for, canapés?
Canapés, yes, yeah. That's right. But they treated us well, and we enjoyed it once the weather improved and found things to do, like taking the engine out of the little ship to get the scow to the shore. We dismembered that and rebuilt it, which was nice. So we found things to do. But we were on it for a long, long time before we hit Montevideo, which was the first first port of call.
What do you mean by long time? Weeks? Months?
Yes, weeks.
Weeks.
Yeah, we were doing 10 knots. Walking pace, really. But it didn't matter. We were enjoying it. We were sleeping well. But the movement in that forward cabin was so violent that when you lift it up, everything came off the floor and revolved around whatever it was tied to. And we had these little tables were bolted to the deck, and we tied all our suitcases around it. And the whole lot just lifted and moved around. We had nowhere to pack anything. You know, we just lived out of a suitcase. It was a rough
passage.
Yeah.
Were you sick?
Yeah. At first, we soon got over it. Some of them were sick for over a month, and we felt for them. You know, they were retching after weeks and weeks. You'd have thought they'd have acclimatised. But eventually they did. One bloke, he came out onto deck. He hadn't been there since Southampton. And it was well over a month. And he said, "It's gone. I feel better." And he never looked back. But that was a violent intro to the sea. We couldn't have picked a worse place. It was December, and a typical winter storm coming out up from the southwest. So we were butting into it. And the sea was coming over in shed loads.
Was it better in the Southern Hemisphere? How was the passage down to Stanley?
Oh, well, once we got into the tropics, then it all changed. We all dried out. We were able to get to meals without getting drenched and things like that. And it all changed completely. And then we got to Stanley, Monte Fido, and that was an eye opener.
In what respect?
Well, we didn't have much in the way of language, and some of them had little beards, which were quite unusual for Europeans in the South America. And then we found steaks that we had never tasted better before, and bought cow hides and things, you know, typical tourists. I've still got some and other things. So it was a nice... I won't say that.
Yeah, you can if you want.
Well, there's one chap, he looked over the... I've always remembered it. He looked over the bow of the ship, and there was a chap coming on a boat... towards the... He was the pilot, wasn't like that. He said, "Just think of this." He said, "This is our first wog." It's awful, isn't it?
Well, that was okay at the time, wasn't it? Well, it wasn't okay, but it was common at the time.
Oh, we howled with laughing. He was an irreverent type.
Mm. What was Port Stanley like?
Well, that was another violent change. I mean, that was like Scotland at its most bleak. But we were a ship full of people, and the Navy were there, HMS Protector. And I was living on board the ship, but I was invited ashore. Clem Clements and his wife, Sadie, who I still exchange Christmas cards with. They live up in Aberdeen way now. And we enjoyed it. And two of our geologists were asked to go out into the camp to look at a water source and see if they could pipe it closer to where they wanted it to go. And we went to help them, you know, just to carry their bags and so on. And that was interesting. We could get a feel for the land, and it's a very broken country, you know, rugged. And the meat was called 365, that's what you heard there.
No.
Well, you can get it every day of the week, every day of the year. But there was nothing wrong with their meat. It was lovely, lovely. They lived very well. Upland geese and sea trout. So it was a good source of living. And we went to the local dances and things like that and eyed up the local girls and they eyed us up. And as life goes on, we were like a serviceman coming down.
Were you there for a while then?
Yes, I was there. Well, we were there then for about 3 weeks, I think. We had to be kitted out. You were kitted out with all your polar gear and your right down to your underpants. And that was all stored in a shed down by the quay. And you finished up with a kit bag full of stuff for 2 years. That didn't take that long, but there was a lot of cargo coming from Stanley to the bases. They had a rock crusher, I seem to remember, which we would get bags of crushed rock because they were making up concrete for foundations, things like that. And that was heavy work, but it's all right. And then I got transferred onto the Biscoe, I think, there, and went down to my first, we went towards the ice then, across the Drake Passage. And that was a moment, you felt at last we're on the doorstep, long times from Hemsby to there.
Did it go straight to Argentine Island?
We went to Deception Island first, then Lockroy. Usually had something to deliver everywhere, and I hadn't been down those bases before, but latterly I visited them each time. We'll come to that later. But we got shoveled ashore at Argentine Islands, and half the base was doing their second year, so there's always some knowledge and experience. And we enjoyed it. It was a beautiful looking base. F it was called then. Faraday then. Now it's called something, Balkan something, isn't it? I don't know what it's called now. But we had a very enjoyable year there. And we did the same stuff, the observations every 3 hours, day and night, and the balloon ascent once a day.
Did you not have a hole in the ceiling or the hole of the roof of the hut to let the balloons out of?
No, it was too big for that.
The balloon was too big?
Yeah. We had a roller gate door. It was a big, big shed. It could stand up and wouldn't touch the top. And when we were ready, we rolled open the gate and then we'd string out the line from the transmitter to the balloon, and there'd be a radar target too, so it was a right bunch of knitting. And then you had to go running as the bloke came out with the balloon, because as soon as he got into the wind, up it went. You couldn't hold it, you had to let it go, and if you weren't far enough to get some vertical displacement, then you did a flying rugby tackle and hoped that it would not bounce, and often it did bounce, and that was it, finished. You can't recover that, it's just smashed to bits. Which was a pity after all that preparation, but we got used to that.
What was the base like at that time? Was it comfortable?
Nice. Yes, very comfortable. Yeah.
And warm?
Yes, I can think of nothing to complain about. Had a good library and records. There were some BBC records down there. I wish I'd pinched a few of them, but they were sent to Stanley for their local radio, and it was round the horn and all the regular known BBC programmes, and they were smashing.
The Goon Show.
Yeah, Goon Show.
Did he tend to learn the sketches over the time you were there?
Not specifically. We listened to it and laughed every time it was played. Good stuff, that. Really good stuff. It was high quality stuff. But it was a nice place. But you kind of lucky there, because you've got this strait, Panola Strait, between the offshore island and the mainland, which was the spine. And that was a very dangerous place, and some people were lost there. You know, they were trying to cross it, and then the ice broke up, and that's it.
So did we get off the island much, if the conditions were a bit dodgy?
Only on boats.
Right.
We skied across to Peterman Island, which was about 10 miles, and stayed the night there. But again, I think now that was a risk.
When you got to Peterman Island, what would you do?
We shot a seal, gutted it, and put the and had the liver, and it was gorgeous. We had some onions, and that was nice. But we were taking risks there.
How do you mean?
Well, the ice looked solid, but you know, you're isolated, and you've got no rescue. A little later, we had a death in Halley Bay, which I expect you know about. And the same thing, the ice broke up. It's only after you've experienced that you think to yourself, God, should we have done that? But there was no embargo on us. We had to stand on our own feet and decide that the risk were worth it. And before my time, some people tried to climb the mountains and got lost. There was a big mountain there. I find mountaineers a funny group. They really are all death and glory, aren't they?
Well, yeah. Glory rather than death, I think they prefer, but sometimes it works out either way.
Yeah. You're a very, very comfortable base.
Your base commander for the first winter was Cyril Aubrey Murray, known as Bill.
Yeah, Bill Murray.
Yeah. What do you make of him?
Well, he was an interesting character. He, a bit public school. You know, we were secondary moderns. But he was a nice man, very nice man, and very gentle with it. He wasn't a martinet. I remember one day we were walking up the beach and he was shouting at somebody about 20 yards up there. He said, "John, can you victual me?" And we looked around and said, "What the hell is he talking about?" Anyway, he had a way with him, this old-fashioned charm. Very nice bloke. He's dead now, but
he appeared on a postage stamp or something, did he?
Yes, he might have done, yes. With a telerometer machine. He was a surveyor. And there was a picture of him and his sidekick next to the telerometer with the mountains in the background, and I think it was used as a stamp design
for the Falkland Islands stamps,
or
the Antarctic
stamps. For the dependencies stamps, we used to be able to get designs made for a commemorative issue or a definitive issue. You could only do a definitive issue now and again. You couldn't press it, but you could do a commemorative issue if you had a reason. And just the cost of printing the stamps made the dependencies a lot of money, because people all over the world wanted them. And we used to get sacks of mail in with the relief just to give them the franc. And that was difficult because we had to do the franking. And that was just a
hand stamp.
Yeah, and it was difficult not to smudge it. And sometimes people just went boom, boom, and it was rubbish. You know, it should have been a specimen hand stamp, and it wasn't very good, and there were complaints about that. They had to try a bit harder.
Some of the base commanders actually resented all that work, didn't they?
They say it wasn't science, so why am I doing it? I said, well, who else is doing it? I used to argue with them about that. You know, it was a money spinner. And it was part of the ethos that we joined. And there were people all around the world who were collecting. I've still got some upstairs, you know, with the franc on them. So, FIDs tend to bitch about nothing if they've got nothing to bitch about.
The ice was pretty heavy that year, wasn't it? Quite a substantial ice year.
What, when we joined back?
Adelaide, yeah.
No. Base F, that's where we were.
I'm sorry, Base F.
Yeah. Yes, it was. It was difficult to get in. Let me think. There were places they couldn't relieve, and they had to either fly them out or walk them out. And close bases up until the following year. So it was a heavy ice year.
There was a party that should have wintered at Adelaide Island. They ended up staying not far from you.
Yes.
At Wordy House.
Wordy House, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a little base that was produced for Panola, the Panola expeditions. And they just wintered there and joined with us. Two bases together, really, just for convenience sake, because they couldn't go where they intended to go.
Mm. What was the distance between the two?
Oh, you could walk over.
And did you?
Mm, often, yeah. Yes, it was a cosy little base, and but they kept to themselves and they didn't come and raid our stores.
Who else do you remember from that first season at Argentine Island? Cool. Well, let me give you a couple of thoughts. Alan Piggott was your radio man, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. I didn't know him very well. He was all right. I wasn't great friends with him. Somehow you either gelled with some people or you didn't. But most of us got on all right together. But Alan Piggott I knew. Bill Murray. Murray? Yeah. God, it's a long time ago now.
Shall I look it up?
Yes.
Yeah, let me just look it up. It's quite a long list. Also at Argentine Island that winter was somebody called Agger.
Gallagher. Agger, yes.
Harkness Haynes.
Harkness was the diesel mech. He was a New Zealander, yeah.
Quinn.
Quinn.
Really?
Well, a bit like that.
Smith, Sparks, Sumner, that's you.
Yes, Sparks was the doctor.
Thomas and Wigglesworth.
Thomas was a Met man, and Wigglesworth was a forecaster. He was he did an extra course to make him capable of giving forecasts for the aircraft.
And was he doing that? He was sending predictive weather, was he?
Well, I think he did it in parts. You know, it wasn't a real setup. You know, the aircraft either turned up or it wasn't available to turn up. You know, it was a bit not a scheduled airline.
Did you see many aeroplanes?
None. Only ours. And only when they came and visited us. No, it's a... I was thinking about that just recently. They were based at Deception Island, the aircraft, which was an ash runway. And they would then take people into the field and deposit them with their depots and then go back. And they wintered in Deception Island, which had big hangars. But it's all a bit dim now, isn't it?
Is there anything I've missed about your time at Argentine Island, or should we move on?
No, I think it was a good year. And then after that, I moved on to somewhere else. Bloody hell, what else was it?
Well, I think you went to Halle.
That's right, I did, yes. Halle Bay.
In 61.
Yeah.
Was that part of the plan, or was that news that was brought to you whilst you were south?
No, it was... I think I volunteered for it. They wanted people to go there. And I wanted to see as much as I could of the bases. And that was a good move. But it's an entirely different environment.
Both you and Dudley Jehan went together and you became a senior Met man.
Yes, that's right.
Was that thrust upon you or something you sought?
No, I've just told. I don't know why me. I just took it on. I mean, it wasn't... Somebody had to be in charge. Somebody had to do the stats, lots of stats for the Met records. And we got quite good at it. Just data collection.
What was your feelings about Halley after having spent time at Argentine Island with a fantastic view?
Yeah.
Apparently it was a bit bleak, wasn't it?
It was a bit bleak, but it didn't seem to matter. We enjoyed what we did. But we almost worked day by day.
How do you mean?
Well, you didn't say, well, Wednesday was a running day or a particular day. You just decide that day what you'd do.
On the strength of the weather, I guess.
Well, yes, or... Yes, on the strength of the weather, yes.
How did it take to living underground?
Well, once you're in, you've got nothing to see outside, because it was all buried by then. It was... The base was built on the side of the hill, but in half a year it had buried, and you had just looking out certain places.
Were you living in the IGY hut or having one?
IGY.
So it was the original
IGY
hut?
Yeah.
Well, tell me about it. What was it like inside?
It was in good condition. I mean, it had buried down to its eaves and was comfortable and warm. And was a good place to be.
How did you get into it?
Well, we had to dig at the front door. There's a shaft into it. No problem at all. And it was a good hut.
And would you have had any mechanical vehicles, or was it just dogs?
We had no mechanical vehicles, as I remember it. We had some dogs. But a lot of it was man hauling.
Yeah.
But we didn't go far. We didn't have to go far because it was a base. The Argentine Islands base was a static station. It had routine readings of meteorological work, so there wasn't much need to travel at all.
But there was a trip to the Totten Fjord, wasn't there? Or Totten Fjella?
That was done by the base commander.
That's Colin Johnson.
Yeah, Colin Johnson. That's right. And his mate. They did a good job there. I'm not quite sure. I'm thinking of the reason for it. Because it's a hell of a way. It's about 800 miles. And... they took dogs and they were prepared to eat them if necessary. But we just travelled locally across the ice cliff and went inland as far as we need. We didn't really get very far there because it was just void, the ice shelf.
But didn't somebody establish the Bob Pye crossing?
Yes.
In your time?
Yes, that's right.
What do you remember of that?
Let me think. That you got to the crevasse zone and then had to pick your way through this chaos. And I think it was the base commander and his mate who found their way across it. It was a bit hairy, but later on I did it myself. But by then it had been well marked. And there were no real dangers of it. There was a hinge zone where the ice shelf met the inland ice, and that was chaotic.
What was special about that particular patch where the Bob Pye crossing was created? Was it less crevassed than surrounding areas?
Well, I think... I can't quite remember. Let me think. When you approach this area, you're looking for signs of how to get across this jumble. And eventually you choose a way which may or may not have been a good one, but you persevered with it and eventually got across. But even after you got across, you still had more broken territory to get across. And we did that. And we're relieved to get across because then we had the inland sea, which the inland frozen bit, which was available to us and could take us right through to the Totten Mountains, which was the promised land.
How do you mean?
Well, we knew it was there. We knew Johnson, the base commander, had got there the year before. And that was a first. You know, it was like a first ascent, really. And then we all wanted to go, of course, and I managed to get there. But it's a long, long way across ice shelf, which is, by and large, it's all fairly secure. You can still fall down holes, but less so, because we'd done that previous work.
So you did this trip yourself. Was that man hauling still, or with dogs?
No, I did it with tractors. It's a long time now, isn't it? We had motor toboggans. We used those. We had some dogs. We used those. And anything but manhaul. That's a waste.
Anything but manhaul.
A bloody waste of time, that was. But we got there eventually, and everybody found their own method, really.
And when he got to the promised land, was it as promising as he'd thought it was going to be?
Well, it was a sort of 18th hole sort of thing. You know, you got to where you wanted to go, and the weather allowed you to. And the weather on the shelf, which was all shelf there, was fairly secure. It wasn't massive crevasses, although you could find them if you wanted to. And it was just plough on 20 miles a day and you eventually get there.
Do you know why or how the Bob Pye Crossing got its name?
Bob Pye Crossing, yeah. We had a physicist there. What was his name? Harmon. He tended to put names like that onto features, which didn't mean much. It's just another way of labelling things, I think.
So it was kind of a nickname, was it?
Yeah. Bob Pye, yes. There's a bit of geometry in it, I think. Pye. Yeah.
I think, wasn't Alan Etchells with you that year?
Yes. Have you interviewed him?
I have.
He was a good mechanic, a sturdy man, just got on with it. A very good engineer.
And you also had Neville Mann with you as well?
Yes.
Who disappeared one night?
Who died, yeah.
What do you remember of that incident, Maurice?
Let me recall. It's vague now, isn't it? I'm not sure where he died. It was whether it was on the crossing or whether it was on the coast. I can't remember now.
I'm reading from Fuchs's Of Ice and Men.
Yeah.
August 63. Gordon Mallinson and Neville Mann took two dog teams and their camera down to the sea ice on a training run, hoping to get some pictures of the ice cliffs. A strong wind arose and they lost each other in the all-enveloping drift. For some time, Mallinson searched without success, and then, confident that Mann must be finding his own way back to base, he returned to base, where he was horrified to discover that his companion was not there.
Yeah.
Then he talks about a search party. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. I don't. It's 50 miles from the base, this loss, I think. You know, it's a vast place. You'd have to wait until the summer to get some light. You'd only have any twilight in the winter time, so I don't remember that.
What do you remember about when the news broke that he hadn't come back, or when Mallinson turned up on his own?
I don't remember that. Mallinson came back on his own. There are proper reports written about this, aren't there? It's a long time since I've read them, or have. I haven't got them now.
Do you remember the atmosphere on the base?
Yeah, I do. But not specifically, I don't.
Okay, if he's not coming back, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
No, okay. Shall we pause there and...
Yeah. Do you want a cup of tea?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.